Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
The U.S. says Egypt and the UAE strike Libyan militants, and 17 are killed in a CAR battle between Seleka factions. I'm Frances Alonso reporting from Washington. Senior U.S. officials say Egypt and the United Arab Emirates have launched airstrikes against Islamic militants in the Libyan capital twice in the past week. U.S. officials tell reporters that the move caught the United States by surprise, potentially dealing a blow to relations between Washington, Cairo, and the Emirates. U.S. officials said Egypt provided the base for the launch of the airstrikes, and the UAE provided the aircraft and pilots. Meanwhile, neither of those governments have commented on the attacks. At least 17 people have been killed in the Central African Republic in clashes between factions of the former rebel movement Seleka. The fighting erupted on Monday in the central town of Bambari. The leader of one of the factions told VOA's French to Africa that today a dispute over control of a checkpoint had sparked the violence. The spokesman said his backers tried to replace the supporters of another rival general, and he said he was uncertain about which faction currently controlled the checkpoint. Zimbabwean President Robert Mugabe is in China on a five-day state visit. The trip comes after he was snubbed by U.S. President Barack Obama, who did not invite him to the recent U.S.-Africa summit. The longtime leader is reportedly seeking $4 billion in a financial boost for his struggling economy. Members of Mr. Mugabe's delegation signed several agreements with Chinese officials. This is VOA News. The fate of nine Pakistani detainees who were held at a U.S. military prison in Afghanistan is a source of friction between Islamabad and Kabul. Ayaz Ghul reports.
As part of its military withdrawal from Afghanistan, the United States has stepped up efforts of winding down its so-called Bagram Detention Center north of Kabul. Since November 2013, the U.S. military has turned over 25 detainees to Pakistan. That release has triggered strong Afghan criticism, even though Washington says Kabul was informed before it took place. Afghan Interior Ministry spokesman Siddiq Siddiqui insists his country is seeking clarifications from the United States. He says the Pakistanis who were arrested by American forces are really dangerous people who posed a threat in the past, and they are a threat today. Ayaz Ghul for VOA News, Islamabad.
This week, lawmakers from Cambodia's opposition party are being voted on to 10 parliamentary commissions. This is part of a key political deal in which the opposition finally agreed to take its 55 seats in parliament. Robert Carmichael reports.
This week's proceedings at Parliament are an important step on the road to political normality. The opposition Cambodia National Rescue Party, or CNRP, boycotted Parliament for months following the July 2013 general election, in which it came close to unseating Prime Minister Hun Sen's Cambodian People's Party. Opposition Party Chief Whip Son Chai says he is optimistic for the future.
I think both parties cannot afford to do what they please anymore. The public is very powerful. I think they were watching two parties very closely. Since the two parties are very much equal in support in this country.
Robert Carmichael for VOA News, Phnom Penh.
Authorities in Brazil say a deadly two-day prison uprising in southern Brazil has ended. Officials say two inmates were beheaded during the riot at Cascavel Penitentiary. Two other inmates were thrown to their deaths from the prison roof, and police are investigating how a fifth inmate died during the riot. Two guards who had been taken hostage were released. The rioting prisoners had demanded better living conditions and transfers to other prisons. A Japanese court has ruled the operator of Japan's Fukushima nuclear power plant is responsible for a death of a woman who committed suicide after being forced to flee her home following the plant's 2011 disaster. Japanese media reports said today that the court ordered Tokyo Electric Power Company to pay $470,000. I'm Frances Alonso.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehia Suhib, and coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
Nigerian officials say they are cracking down on hunting and discouraging the use of wild animals for entertainment to stave off the spread of Ebola. But as the busy hunting season approaches at the end of the summer rains, some hunters say, regardless of the risk, they will go back to work.
That's Heather Murdoch reporting from Abuja. Details coming up.
Also in the news, it's been a deadly year for migrants trying to reach Italy from North Africa. And Zimbabwean President Robert Mugabe is in China on a five-day visit.
We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from Ghana, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story this hour, the United Nations envoy on Ebola calls the effort to contain the epidemic in West Africa a war that will take at least 6 months to end. Dr. David Nabarro made the comment in Sierra Leone during his visit this week to the Ebola-affected countries. Dr. Tom Frieden of the U.S. Centers for Disease Control said the Ebola virus has the upper hand in West Africa. He said, "We have the means to stop it, but it requires tremendous attention to every detail." The World Health Organization's latest figures indicate more than 1,400 people have died of Ebola out of more than 2,600 confirmed cases. However, the survival rate of 47% in the current outbreak is much higher than in smaller previous outbreaks in Central Africa. Health workers are among the hardest hit populations. Nabarro said the death rate among health workers is unprecedented. 240 have been infected and 120 of those have died. The WHO has called the many government and airline travel bans unnecessary and counterproductive. It says they prevent movement of health workers needed in the fight against Ebola.
In Liberia, President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf has dismissed several government ministers who refused her order days ago to return to work during the epidemic. Also in Liberia, with the death of Dr. Abraham Borbor in Monrovia over the weekend, the effectiveness of the trial treatment ZMAP is uncertain. Borbor was the chief medical officer at one of Monrovia's largest hospitals. Several others who have taken ZMAP have recovered or are still under treatment. However, the drug manufacturer has exhausted its supply of ZMAP. Meanwhile, the Japanese government has offered an experimental influenza drug for use in the epidemic. A second Ebola outbreak is underway in the Democratic Republic of Congo, but it is not related to what's happening in West Africa. Two deaths from the disease have been confirmed in the DRC. Measures are being taken to quarantine the region and to place a ban on bush hunting. The DRC outbreak is believed to be a different strain of Ebola than what's spreading in West Africa.
Also, Yehia's countries affected by the Ebola outbreak continue to announce tougher measures to check the spread of the disease, including possible jail time for those accused of hiding Ebola patients. But public health experts say the get-tough approach won't work and may just alienate affected communities even more. VOA's Ann Look spoke to a Senegalese socio-anthropologist who spent a month in Sierra Leone studying the impact of this Ebola outbreak and has this report.
Senegalese socio-anthropologist Cheikh Ibrahim Niar says it's the days he spent in the village of Injala that have stuck with him the most from his month of research in eastern Sierra Leone. Injala used to be home to about 300 people, but many houses were empty. Whole families were dead.
Quand nous avons commencé à travailler avec eux, les villageois nous ont dit c'est la première fois qu'une personne nous écoute. Au bout de plus d'un mois,
he says his team started doing their interviews and people told them it was the first time anyone had listened to them. They said we have had 46 people die in the past month and no one has come to see us or talk to us. Nyar said he heard this a lot. He said people are being left out of decisions about efforts to save them. And it's no wonder there's resistance.
Il y a tout ce travail de discussion, de persuasion qu'on aurait pu faire, et à la place de ça, on est venu avec des méthodes autoritaires.
Nyar says there's this whole work of discussion and persuasion that could have been done, but instead we have authoritarian methods, and when you go that route, you will have problems. He was there in the town of Kenema on July 25th when a mob tried to attack an Ebola treatment center. Police dispersed them with live bullets and tear gas. A mentally unstable woman had declared that Ebola is a hoax. But Nyar says there was more going on.
Donc ce n'est pas un déni, mais c'est surtout l'expression.
He says these incidents are not really about denying Ebola exists. He says they are an expression of the tension, the anguish people feel. And he says above all, they are a cry for reassurance and support. Affected countries and their neighbors are shutting borders, even as the World Health Organization cautions against it. Airlines are shutting down flights to and from affected countries. Sierra Leone and Liberia have security forces manning barricades and imposing quarantines. Meanwhile, Nyar says health centers and health workers in the affected areas are overwhelmed and under-equipped.
Au niveau international, au niveau de la communauté internationale, on n'a pas eu cette volonté politique à partir de laquelle on aurait pu engager des énergies.
Nyar says people he spoke to expressed a frustration, a real anger at having been practically abandoned. Containing Ebola is complex. The virus is transmitted either through eating bushmeat or through contact with the bodily fluids of an infected person. To stop an outbreak, people have to change their behaviors, their traditions. A mother cannot care for her sick child. She's not even supposed to touch him. Families cannot bury their dead as they always have. This is the domain of the sacred, Nyar said, the absolute, the familial bonds and emotions that make us human. He says people need convincing. Governments are resorting to force. Sierra Leone's parliament voted yes this week on a law to throw people in jail for as much as 2 years for harboring suspected Ebola patients. Nyar says those measures will not work.
D'abord reconnaître le statut des personnes. Il faudrait arrêter le paternalisme.
He says this paternalistic approach has to stop. It's like we're treating people like children. Listen, take this, do that, this is good for you. Instead, he says authorities should recognize that they are dealing with a mature population and talk to them adult to adult to find solutions together. According to the Sierra Leone Ministry of Health, Ebola has killed 341 people in that country this year, with the total number of confirmed cases nearing 1,000. And look, VOA News, Dakar.
And Nigerian officials say they are cracking down on hunting and discouraging the use of wild animals for entertainment to stave off the spread of Ebola. But as the busy hunting season approaches at the end of the summer rains, some hunters say regardless of the risk, they will go back to work. Heather Murdoch has more from Abuja.
Yesterday, in the northern city of Kaduna, six men from a remote village with small baboons came to town looking for an audience. Usually, when animal trainers come to the city, people flock to watch monkeys dance in trousers or baboons mimic farmers and herders. But hundreds of kilometers from the nearest Ebola case, no one wanted to be near the animals. Shola Adebayo, a father of five, explains.
I can never, for now, allow my even my children to go to watch either monkey or anything. I'm not interested due to the reality that people are there having the understanding that this disease is rising through transmission.
Since the first case of Ebola in Nigeria in July, the government has conducted a massive nationwide campaign encouraging sanitation and discouraging interaction with animals and bushmeat, which can spread the disease to people who pass it to each other through bodily fluids. Nearly 1,400 people have died of Ebola since the outbreak began in February, all but seven in Liberia, Sierra Leone, and Guinea. Over the weekend, the Democratic Republic of Congo was the fifth country to record Ebola deaths this year. But some analysts say because Congo has identified a different strain of Ebola, its outbreak may be unconnected to the West Africa outbreak. A spokesman for the Kaduna state government, Ahmed Mayakim, says his state is now enforcing already in place hunting bans to keep hunters away from animals and to halt the sale of bushmeat.
We have a responsibility to safeguard, you know, the lives and, you know, the welfare and well-being of our people. So we are calling on them to abide by the provision of the law and ensure that we don't get ourselves into things that are inimical to the society, things that is dangerous to your health, that can lead you to death.
Hunters say enforcing this ban is not difficult now, when heavy rains keep most of them at home.
When they get here, I mean, they were halal, or Gaskia.
This is Musa Mebigadar, who makes his living hunting monkeys and other animals to be sold as meat at the market. The local hunters' union, he says, has agreed not to hunt for the meantime, but they will go back to work when the weather is dry. He believes officials when they say Ebola can be transmitted from animals to people, he says, but this has never happened in Nigeria, where people have been eating bushmeat as long as anyone can remember. For now, he adds, people aren't even buying bushmeat for fear of Ebola. But like the hunters, he says, he thinks people will eventually be more afraid of hunger than disease. Heather Murdoch for VOA News, Abuja.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
I'm Yisru Heap, 17 past the hour. Here's a recap of our top stories. Countries affected by the Ebola outbreak continue to announce tougher measures to check the spread of the disease. According to the International Organization for Migration, it's been a deadly year for migrants trying to reach Italy from North Africa. And Zimbabwean President Robert Mugabe is in China on a five-day state visit and would like to hear your thoughts on our stories. You can write to us at Africa News Tonight, Voice of America, 330 Independence Avenue, Southwest Washington, D.C., 20237.
The International Organization for Migration, IOM, says the series of tragedies that took place last weekend in the Mediterranean marks one of the deadliest periods for the year for migrants trying to reach Italy from North Africa. An estimated 230 migrants are lost and presumed dead. In one incident, 200 went missing during a shipwreck 32 nautical miles off the coast of Libya. In another case, six passengers drowned after a fishing boat capsized with some 370 migrants on board. Flavio Di Giacomo is the IOM spokesperson in Rome. He describes another account involving a boat 120 nautical miles off the coast of Italy.
18 dead bodies were found on a rubber dinghy, which was rescued by the Italian authorities. We met yesterday the 73 survivors of this dinghy, who are now in Sicily, and it came out that the 18 dead migrants who were on the dinghy were people who were beaten by traffickers at the moment of their departure. They were severely injured, also in the head. They were bleeding. And when the dinghy started to have problems taking on water and the engine had a fuel leak, they did not have the strength to save themselves swimming. They died, probably suffocated by the fumes of the engine, while those who left the boat swimming were rescued by an Italian ship. 73 people made it, while other 8 people, unfortunately, drowned while swimming.
What countries were these migrants from?
The countries were on this rubber dinghy were mainly sub-Saharan Africans, so Malian, Gambians, people coming from Nigeria as well. There were also 7 Palestinians who were coming from a refugee camp at the Syrian border. But in general, people coming to Italy this year, we noticed that this year there has been and been characterized by the presence of many people fleeing from wars and persecutions, and the main represented nationalities are Syrians, Eritreans, Somali, and other nationalities, of course.
And I know you have touched on this many times in the past, a safe voyage for the migrants. So what can be done, even though we know that that is ultimately not the solution to the problem, but since they are in the process of leaving, what can be done to make their lives safer and also to allow them to legally enter a country?
What has been put in place so far is the operation carried out by the Italian government, which is called Mare Nostrum, which saved thousands of lives during 2014. An operation started last October. But generally speaking, people are suffering a lot. They continue to reach Italy and put their lives in the hands of traffickers, unscrupulous traffickers, who oblige them to travel on unsafe vessels. This is not an emergency in terms of excess of migrants reaching Europe, even if 100,000 migrants are a lot. But it is an emergency because all these people, they risk their lives at sea. And before coming to Italy, they are obliged to suffer a severe human rights violation in Libya and during their trip. It means that it would be needed probably to provide them with a possibility of legally entering in Europe, at least for these migrants who come to Europe because they can be entitled to get some kind of protection. Because the situation will not change in the next few months because of the geopolitical situation, because of the war in Syria, for example. So the unrest and the political instability of Libya have also deteriorated the situation in the country that has become too dangerous for migrants. And all the migrants we are talking to tell us that it's very, very dangerous for them now to live in Libya. They cannot even walk in the street, especially for sub-Saharan Africans. They can be beaten, they can be kidnapped, they can even be killed without any specific reason. So they do not have any other choice but to risk their lives trying to reach Europe.
What then happens to them once they reach Europe?
All the people arrived here in Italy have applied, most of them at least, for asylum request. Some of them, like many Syrians, they managed to escape from the centers because they want to meet and reach the relatives who are often living in northern Europe. But generally speaking, those people now, they are transferred by the Italian authorities from Sicily to the other Italian regions in the many reception facilities which have been created for those migrants. And then the application procedure will be carried out during the year.
Are the migrants that you're seeing now, are they mostly men or are these whole families that are traveling?
The Syrians, for example, are composed mainly by families, so women and children. When we are talking about other nationalities, the situation is a bit different because there are, of course, many men. There are also many women, but the most impressive thing is that there are many unaccompanied minors. For example, I have the data updated to the first 7 months of the year, so updated to the 31st of July of this year. There were almost 14,000 minors who arrived in Italy. Among them, 8,500 were unaccompanied minors, so a lot of minors as well.
That was Flavio Di Giacomo, an IOM spokesperson. He spoke with me from Rome.
UNICEF says August has been the busiest month in the last 10 years for conducting its emergency airlifts. The UN's Children's Fund has rushed needed supplies to simultaneous humanitarian crisis. VOA's Jody Capua reports.
Chanel Hall is director of UNICEF's supply division, based in Copenhagen.
For us, there's been massive needs, and that's required a massive response. Many of them have come together at the same time, hitting us in this month of August.
The airlifts have brought supplies, ranging from food to shelter to medical goods, to 8 countries and 1 territory.
Central African Republic, Palestine, Liberia, Iraq, South Sudan, in Syria, including the neighboring countries where Syrian kids are, so Lebanon and Jordan as well.
Airlifts are much more expensive to use than truck convoys.
Usually we resort to airlifting cargo really on the onset of an increase in need, so we call it our rapid response. When the need is so acute that we need to rapidly get supplies in, when supplies that may be already in country or were pre-positioned are starting to be exhausted.
As of August 25th, UNICEF had conducted 36 emergency airlifts, carrying over 1,200 metric tons. Some of the supplies heading for Syria and Iraq are to help children deal with the effects of conflict.
We're shipping what we call early childhood development kits and recreation kits to give to kids to start, if you will, their psychosocial care. Their displays, they're in camps or other places where they're settling, and they still have some way of expressing themselves through play or through sport.
It's not only conflict situations. UNICEF has begun airlifting medical supplies to Liberia for use in the Ebola epidemic. Hall says it's a collective effort. UNICEF works closely with governments and NGOs in the affected areas. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
Zimbabwean President Robert Mugabe is in China on a five-day visit. The trip comes after he was snubbed by U.S. President Barack Obama, who did not invite him to the recent U.S.-Africa summit. The longtime leader is reportedly seeking a $4 billion financial boost for his nation's struggling economy. From VOA's Southern Africa Bureau in Johannesburg, Anita Powell has more.
Zimbabwean President Robert Mugabe has long been known for his fiery, combative, anti-Western rhetoric. And so, as he ventured east this week for a five-day state visit to China, the host government greeted him with a 21-gun salute. Members of Mr. Mugabe's delegation on Monday signed a bevy of agreements with Chinese officials, though the details of the agreements were not released. It's an increasingly rare welcome for a leader who has fewer and fewer places to turn. He and many members of his inner circle face strict sanctions and travel bans from the West for years of alleged election rigging and human rights abuses. Earlier this year, First Lady Grace Mugabe was denied a visa for a trip to the EU, and earlier this month, U.S. President Barack Obama pointedly left Mr. Mugabe off the guest list for a summit of African leaders. Yeju Kim is a research analyst at the Center for Chinese Studies at Stellenbosch University in South Africa. She says the Zimbabwe-China friendship isn't new. Mr. Mugabe sought support from China during Zimbabwe's independence struggle in the late 1970s.
Actually, this is not the first time for Mugabe to visit China. As we all know, Zimbabwe was not invited to attend the U.S.-African summit this year, August. So even before, U.S. and the EU imposed sanctions against Mugabe, so he adopted a look-east policy.
But Mr. Mugabe needs more than friendship. Zimbabwe's economy is once again in turmoil, with widespread power outages and reports of companies being forced to close or stop paying employees. Zimbabwean media have reported that Mr. Mugabe is asking Chinese leaders for $4 billion. Mr. Mugabe's spokesman did not answer repeated calls seeking comment on the reports. Kim says that the two nations have long had financial ties, with a number of Chinese mining and construction firms already working in Zimbabwe.
The country has to find out another economic opportunity from other countries, let's say from Asia. And considering Zimbabwe has been suffering from economic stagnation, China is giving the country a great opportunity. That's why Mugabe has to visit China, actually.
But she says if Zimbabwe gets the money it seeks, there will be a price. Zimbabwe is rich in natural resources like minerals, timber, and metals, making it a potentially lucrative investment for China. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
This is Africa News Tonight with Kim Lewis. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. It's 28 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
Normudu. Please join me live every Tuesday at 17:30 UTC in VOA's health program, Health Chat. Hear from doctors, nurses, international experts discussing the health issues of your concern. Health Chat puts listeners directly in touch with medical professionals. You can talk to them live for free or email your questions. Health Chat brings the medical professionals to your home.
Dr. Anthony Fauci, director of National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, speaks to VOA on the Ebola crisis.
The people of the nation, the best thing that they can do is to try as best as possible to cooperate with the health authorities and to listen to and adhere to the suggestions and guidelines. We appreciate that this is something that is really awful to be going through. We're with you, we have solidarity with you, and hopefully we'll be able to end this terrible epidemic very soon.
That was Dr. Anthony Fauci, Director of National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, speaking to VOA on the Ebola crisis.
This is Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. Countries affected by the Ebola outbreak continue to announce tougher measures to check the spread of the disease. It's been a deadly year for migrants trying to reach Italy from North Africa, and Zimbabwean President Robert Mugabe is in China on a five-day visit. Coming up, we have music from Ghana, and in our feature segment, poachers have killed more than 100,000 African elephants in the past 3 years. I'm Kim Lewis with Yehia Swuhib, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sunny is next. It's time now for the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young. Hello, Sunny.
Hello, Kim.
Well, Sunny, I understand you are kicking off today with African football.
Yes, Kim. Let's kick off with African football. Ghana, Kenya, and Ethiopia say they're interested in hosting the 2017 Africa Cup of Nations tournament after Libya's withdrawal as the host country last week. The Libyans pulled out because of violence in the country. The Confederation of African Football, CAF, then set a September 30th deadline for countries to express their interest in staging the competition. Ghana has hosted African football's premier event three times, in 1963, 1978, and 2008. Also in 2000, Ghana co-hosted the Nations Cup with Nigeria. Writing on his Twitter page, Ghana's sports minister, Mahama Ayaraga, said, and I quote, "I am happy to announce that Ghana will bid to host the 2017 Africa Cup of Nations." Meanwhile, the president of the Ethiopian Football Federation, Junuddin Basha, says his government is ready and interested in doing everything it can to bring the Nations Cup back to Ethiopia for the first time since 1976. The Ethiopians also staged the tournament in 1962 and 1968. The Kenyans have never hosted the Nations Cup. They say they're also considering a joint bid with Tanzania, Uganda, or Rwanda. Our VOA football fans will remember the 2015 Africa Cup of Nations will be hosted by Morocco from January 17th to February 8th. The Moroccans previously hosted the African Football Jamboree in 1988. The Moroccans are planning to stage the 16-team tournament in four cities, Agadir, Marrakesh, Rabat, and Tangier. Well, Algeria had a lot to cheer about at the recent World Cup in Brazil, where the country's national team, nicknamed the Desert Foxes, reached the round of 16 for the first time in the country's history. But the cheers have faded, and now there is sadness following the death of Cameroonian player Albert Ebosse during an Algerian league match. Ebosse died after being hit in the head by a stone thrown by fans as he was leaving the pitch. In the wake of his death, the Algerian Football Federation has suspended all matches, as we hear now from our Daybreak Africa sportsman, Mark Auma.
Club competitions in Algeria are suspended following the death of JS Kabylie's Cameroonian striker Albert Ebosse in Tiziouzou on Saturday. The Algerian Football Federation head Mohamed Raurao disclosed in Algiers Ebosse had equalized for his side through a penalty during the match against USM Algiers. USM Algiers eventually won the match 2-1. The 1st of November stadium in Tiziouzou, where the tragedy took place, has been closed indefinitely. On a more cheerful note, Nigerian attacking midfielder Asisat Oshoala was bestowed with the Adidas Golden Ball Award for being the most outstanding player at the just concluded FIFA Women's Under 20 World Cup in Canada. She also received the Adidas Golden Ball Award for the tournament's top scorer with 7 goals to her credit. Meanwhile, Stephen Keshi will resume duties as head coach of the African Champions Nigeria Super Eagles for at least the first 2 matches in their 2015 Africa Cup of Nations qualifiers next month. Keshi's contract expired at the end of the 2014 FIFA World Cup and had yet to receive a fresh mandate to continue guiding the African champions. To avert a crisis, Nigeria Sports Ministry and the Nigeria Football Federation reached an agreement to hand Keshi a mandate to handle the Super Eagles for the first 2 AFCON qualifiers early next month, while negotiations for a substantive contract are in progress.
The Voice of America, VOA.
I'm Manny Pacquiao, the fighter from the Philippines. When I start boxing, I'm inspired to fight because of my family. We're very poor. When I'm in training for the big fight, I train hard. Get up in the morning, 6 o'clock, jogging, 1 hour. After that, rest. I go to the gym, we do training. Sometimes I want more. I train hard. I used to train in karate. Right now, I'm inspired to fight for the honor of my country.
Manny Pacquiao, the Pac-Man, is on an international tour to promote his fight against American Chris Algieri on November 22nd in Macau, China. Pacquiao and Algieri were in Macau Monday and in Shanghai Tuesday. Over the next couple of weeks, they'll also do promotional events here in the USA, in San Francisco, Los Angeles, Las Vegas, and New York. Algieri is 30 years old and is a former kickboxing champion. Since turning to boxing, he's won 20 consecutive fights without a loss with 8 knockouts. He's also 14 centimeters taller than the Pac-Man, who says Algieri's height advantage could pose a problem.
The biggest challenge for me is to fight another tall guy, and of course, I have to, you know, I have to use my speed and you know, footwork for this fight.
At stake in this fight will be Pacquiao's WBO welterweight title. The Pac-Man has won world titles in 8 weight divisions during his prize fighting career, compiling a record of 56 wins, 5 losses, and 2 draws with 38 knockouts. Let's hear how the challenger, Chris Algieri, sizes up Manny Pacquiao.
That's probably the number one thing that would concern me would be his experience. In terms of his speed and footwork and the things that he does that everyone looks at when they think of Manny, I'm not so worried about that stuff. Because for me, what I feel is the great equalizer in boxing is the jab. I don't care what you got. I don't care how strong you are. I don't care how fast you are. A good jab and a good mind can neutralize anything.
That's American boxer Chris Algieri, who's hoping to neutralize Manny Pacquiao on November 22nd in Macau, China.
Voice of America!
Voice of America's news, talk, and music programs are now at the tip of your fingers. Find everything at www.voaafrica.com. Listen to VOA's program lineup live anytime, day or night. Pick out your favorite shows and listen anytime you want. Download our podcasts. Check VOA Mobile from your cell phone. Subscribe to VOA Newsfeed. VOAnews.com.
VOA!
I encourage our VOA listeners with internet access to check out the Sunny Side of Sports Facebook page. The address is facebook.com/VOA Sunny. Once again, that address, facebook.com/VOA Sunny. You'll see photos and videos, and you can post your comments. So check out the Sunny Side of Sports Facebook page. Jossie Annie wrote at my Facebook page that he listens to the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday on Sports Radio 88.9 Brilla FM in Lagos, Nigeria. Jossie says he's a student in Nigeria's commercial capital. And like more than a few Nigerians, Jossie is a big football fan. I took a peek at Jossie's Facebook page, and he has a photo posted of Mario Balotelli, who recently returned to the English Premier League with Liverpool after playing in Italy for AC Milan. Balotelli previously played for Manchester City in the EPL from 2010 to 2013. Also at my Facebook page, you'll see a photo taken in 2004 at our Voice of America headquarters here in Washington. Liberian football great George Weah, the only African player ever to be named the FIFA World Player of the Year, visited VOA and posed for some photos, including one with me and my former colleague, Uncle Ted Roberts.
Is everything okay? Is everything all right? I hope so.
Friends, we can all listen to the Sunny Side of Sports.
Yes, my friend.
Keep on the sunny side, always on the sunny side. Keep on the sunny side of life. It will help us every day. It will brighten all the way. It will keep on the sunny side of life.
Voice of America, VOA, Washington.
I'm Sonny Young in Washington, and you're listening to the Sunny Side of Sports on the Voice of America.
Voice of America!
Turning to tennis, first round action is continuing at the U.S. Open tournament in New York. Two-time defending women's champion Serena Williams will begin defense of her title later Tuesday against American countrywoman Taylor Townsend. Meanwhile, Serena's older sister, Venus, got off to a winning start in New York Monday, rallying to beat Japan's Kamiko Datekrum in three sets, 2-6, 6-3, and 6-3. Now, this match featured two of the oldest players in professional women's tennis, 34-year-old Venus Williams versus 43-year-old Kamiko Datekrum. Speaking after the match, Venus said she has no plans to retire, saying, and I quote, "According to Kamiko, I have another decade. She set the prime example. She's top 100 and no one can beat her easily. She's breaking the mold," says Venus. It's been 6 years since Venus Williams won a Grand Slam singles title, and in her words, "People have been trying to retire me since I was like 25. Elsewhere in the women's draw, fourth-ranked Agnieszka Rawanska and fifth-ranked Maria Sharapova won their first-round matches in straight sets, while on the men's side, top-seeded Novak Djokovic and British star Andy Murray also won their opening matches at the Grand Slam tournament. I'm VOA Sonny Young, and that's the Sunny Side of Sports. Back to Yahias Wuhib and Kim Lewis.
All right, go Venus. And listen to the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 1631 UTC and 1831 UTC. And on Fridays, Sunny has an expanded half-hour edition of the Sunny Side of Sports at 1730 hours UTC, right here on the Voice of America.
Coming up in our feature segment, poachers kill more than 100,000 African elephants in the past 3 years. And next, in South Sudan, more women are turning up for prenatal and maternal services at the state hospital in Yambio. But first, some music. Here is Blacksmith DXD from Ghana with Azonto Party.
It's a brand new one from Blacksmith and DXD.
Baby.
You know how we do. Follow me, just follow me.
rock. My body don't hurt nobody. Just follow me, girl. Follow me, just follow me, girl. Follow me, just follow me, girl. Let's go to my party don't hurt nobody.
Let's go to my Zonto party. Hey. Zonto party. Let's go to my Zonto party. Come on. Zonto party. Let's go to my Zonto party. Zonto party. Let's go to my Zonto party. Zonto party.
Zonto party.
Let's go to my Zonto party. Grab somebody. The girls they look so fly. The boys they try. Go black for the party. One by one move here to Bacardi. Girls already just got no panties. Hey, you see them, I them. We talk them and prove them. Cause me a fresh boy, me sugar be a eye. Trailing up really, girl, we are feeling lonely. No cheating, no, no killing, no, no fighting, no, no feeling. Show the party, the bean and the pop champagne. And you all night long, show my sexy ladies.
Good girls
all
the gone back. So if I catch you, that's if I dig out. Stop, follow me.
Follow me, just follow me. My body don't hurt nobody. Just follow me, girl. Follow me, girl. Follow me, just follow me, girl. Let's go to my body don't hurt nobody.
Let's go to my Zonto party. Hey. Zonto party. Let's go to my Zonto party. Come on. Zonto party. Let's go to my Zonto party. Zonto party. Let's go to my Zonto party. Zonto party. Zonto party.
Step 1, 2. I know what you're gonna do. And I'm tempted to call you my boo. My boo. When I didn't talk, it be true. I need to do for food. You know me. So now you wanna try, you can never, never try. It takes self to feel me, to watch your minion signs, I'm in the TV. Hey.
Let's go to my Zonto party. Hey. Zonto party. Let's go to my Zonto party. Come on. Zonto party. Let's go to my Zonto party.
Blacksmith DXD from Ghana with Zonto party.
Well, poachers have killed more than 100,000 African elephants in the past 3 years, according to a new study released by researchers working in Kenya, the United States, and the United Kingdom. George Wittemeyer, who led the study, tells Ricky Shryock that this report is the first to provide scientifically reliable numbers on how many elephants are killed every year in Africa for their ivory.
Before this, we haven't had definitive numbers on which to discuss or act. It also provides a really interesting case study in the Samburu system, which shows the level of illegal killing in that population was strongly related to the local black market ivory price that the poachers are getting in the Samburu system, and that's strongly correlated with the volume of ivory that's flowing through Kenya as a nation.
How many elephants per year has your study concluded are being killed due to illegal poaching?
The average is a little over 30,000 a year. And over the period 2010 to 2012, unfortunately, it looks like we lost over 100,000 elephants on the continent.
And are this multiple species of elephants?
This is focused on African elephants. There's some debate if the forest versus savanna are different species. And we just lumped them all together and treated them as one for this study. So it's just elephants on the continent of Africa.
Did your study find that the killing for ivory was also linked to the amount of unrest in a certain region, for example, Central African Republic?
Well, we didn't actually focus on that, but I guess anecdotally, it certainly can. And some of the worst hit countries are the least stable, so you could take that to mean it does. But it's more complicated than that, actually, and still waiting to find out. But it looks like in Central African Republic, through all this impact, that they really experienced massive declines in their elephants, you know, a decade before this, or 2 decades before, really in the 70s and 80s. And so the unrest right now has caused problems for elephants there. But actually, the elephants in that country, if the information we're getting on the ground, it looks like the elephants haven't been decimated during the most recent civil war. And part of that is because they can escape to other regions of Africa where it's more safe. So you can go into the Republic of Congo or Cameroon. And so they may be doing that.
What's the best kind of average price you can give me for an ounce of ivory?
We usually talk about it by the kilo, and that's a really tough question. So in the end market in China, the most coveted pieces can be in the thousands of dollars per kilo. For the poacher on the ground in Samburu, which is where the only numbers we actually have, in 2011 when we had the worst killing, it got up to about $150 a kilo to the poacher.
So if I am someone who lives in Central Africa and ivory could reap me thousands of dollars and I don't have any other way to make money, how can you convince people not to kill elephants?
I think it's a really tough one to crack. And with the value of ivory this high, I think we're just going to constantly have pressure. So the key is to break the demand, to reduce the demand where the price goes down again and we don't have this pressure.
Are there things being looked into where the elephants can provide an economic stability to the people around them without having to kill them and sell their ivory?
There's a lot of examples of this. Tourism and sustainable legal hunting provides a lot of funding to a lot of these rural communities.
That was George Wittemeyer, an assistant professor in the Colorado State University's Department of Fish, Wildlife, and Conservation Biology. He was speaking to Ricky Shryock from Fort Collins, Colorado.
In South Sudan, health officials in western Equatoria State say more women are turning up for prenatal and maternal services at the state hospital in Yambio. They say there has been a big jump in the number of women delivering at the hospital last month compared to previous months. Gift Friday reports from Yambio.
Joy Justin is one of the lucky mothers who received a post-delivery kit from an Azande community in the U.S. city of Portland, Maine, containing a towel, rubber pants, and clothing for mothers and child, among other items to help with the first few months of a newborn's life. Justin says after having 9 children, this is the first time she has ever received this kind of donation.
Before, as we used to deliver here, these things that were brought, we have not seen them. This is the first time. Thank you so much. May God bless you.
Expectant mother Cecilia Simon says she has no money, so she is extremely grateful for the support of the Azande women's community in Maine.
I am very happy for bringing our things. Where could I get money to afford it? Thanks for those who sent it. I give thanks to them. God bless them so that they may send more.
Keturah Charles, a mother of 2, says she too appreciates the donations from the United States.
It is a very good initiative that they have done. This is my second child, but it has never happened to me before.
Esther Benny Martin is a representative of the Azande women in Portland, Maine. She says this small donation to Yambe Hospital can make a big difference to new mothers. But she says more must be done at the hospital to improve pre- and postnatal care.
They need to clean the hospital, especially where the baby and mother are. It wasn't that clean for the babies and their mother. So in other areas, the nurse stations, it need to be covered with nice material, even though it's white stuff, blankets. Other than that, it's better than last time when I was here. It's a good improvement.
The medical director of Yambe State Hospital, Dr. Ismail Muhammad, appreciates the initiative. Dr. Muhammad says Western Equatoria residents welcome the help and look forward to more donations from Benny and others in the U.S. diaspora.
Situation of our mothers, the post-delivered mothers here in the hospital, they need support, and we are very happy to receive you here in Yambe State Hospital. We are looking forward to continue supporting our mothers because we know their situations.
In 2012, the same community in the United States donated beds, bed sheets, and other supplies for the hospital. And he says he thanks to partners like the French medical charity MSF Spain. The hospital has far more human resources at the hospital than it did over the last couple of years. They now have 7 medical doctors compared to 4 2 to 3 years ago. Mohammed thanked the United Nations Development Program for donating sophisticated laboratory equipment, a blood bank, a TB department, a digital X-ray machine, and 2 ultrasound scanning machines. Esnat Ndlovu, a UNFPA, United Nations Population Fund midwife at the hospital, says the prenatal kits will help many mothers in the hospital. Esnat says Yambe State Hospital recently broke a record in the number of its deliveries. Even with these improvements, she says, too many mothers are still dying in childbirth.
The transport and the referral system from the clinics, if they have complications, it's a challenge for them to come this side. Our wish was if the referral system could be strengthened and also the staff could be increased so that they do not have home deliveries.
MSF field manager Vangelia Moka says Doctors Without Borders is providing more training for hospital staff to ensure the number of safe deliveries, but more must be done.
In hospital level, we don't lose mothers, but we don't know what is going on outside. Yeah, in hospital level, the mortality is very low, but we are losing a lot of babies. Due to malaria, the mothers are delivering earlier, so those babies cannot survive in such kind of context.
It is said that Western Ekuatoria State has had the highest mortality rate in the country over the last couple of years. For VOA News, I'm Gift Friday in Yambio.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to Africa News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24-7, visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, John Dryden, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
International conventions prohibit child marriage and define 18 as the age of adulthood because children and adolescents are not mature enough to make choices about marriage. In fact, child marriage is a human rights violation and one that disproportionately affects poor girls. Yet every year, an estimated 14 million girls under age 18 are married worldwide with little or no say in the matter. Early marriage harms both the girls and their children. Adolescent girls and others as young as 8 are a long way from being ready to become wives and mothers. Girls who marry early often quit school. Too frequently, they become pregnant before their bodies are fully developed, and thus they run a high risk of dying as a direct result of pregnancy or childbirth. Worldwide, girls aged 15 to 19 account for 70,000 such deaths each year. In developing countries, the infants of mothers under the age of 18 have a 60% higher risk of dying in their first year of life than do infants born to mothers older than 19. Such children are more likely to suffer from low birth weight, undernutrition, and late physical and cognitive development. They are also less likely to go to school and to achieve higher levels of education. And because child marriage stunts girls' educational opportunities and income-earning prospects, it perpetuates poverty in their communities. Thus, because delaying the age of marriage not only benefits the girls themselves, but their families and communities. The United States, through the U.S. Agency for International Development, or USAID, committed an additional $4.8 million to fund programs in Bangladesh, Burkina Faso, Ethiopia, India, Nepal, Tanzania, and Yemen to end child, early, and forced marriage. These programs, which will focus on education, advocacy for child marriage legislation, and enforcement and economic incentives, are yet another facet of U.S. support for the advancement of women and girls. Ending child marriage will not only remove a major barrier to global progress, but also help ensure a world where girls can look forward to growing up, said USAID Administrator Rajiv Shah. Together, we can build a future in which all children have the opportunity to reach their full potential.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. If you have a comment, please write to Editorials, VOA, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. You may also comment and view all our current editorials at the VOA Editorials homepage, www.voanews.com/editorials.
Hello, I'm Linor Moudou. Please join me live every Tuesday at 17:30 UTC in VOA's health program, Health Chat. Hear from doctors, nurses, international experts discussing the health issues of your concern. Health Chat puts listeners directly in touch with medical professionals. You can talk to them live for free or email your questions. Health Chat brings the medical professionals to your home.